Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
It's not just a matter of being in time with the click. I mean, obviously, we're talking about sequences and we're talking about stuff that if it's just not tight, it sounds sloppy. And I was just thinking right now about losing a click. The one time it ever happened to me, which was not a mix issue, I am fairly energetic when I play, and I did something and I pulled my in-ears clean out of my head. Uh-huh. And this was at the farewell show 14 years ago. So I'm up on stage singing. This might be the last one.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
I'm going to do my best BBC well service voice. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And please, Elon Rubin, welcome to Curious Creatures.
That's a delightful introduction. Thank you for having me.
So I would imagine people would primarily, and tell me if I'm wrong, but primarily they would know you as the drummer in Nine Inch Nails, right?
I would say so, yes.
But you do a lot of other things, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah. We're recording this in black and white, but for those of you listening in color, Elon is wearing a very nice Hawaiian shirt this evening. It's very snazzy. Where did you pick that one up from, Elon?
It's great that you pointed out my black-on-black uniform. I just have a closet full of 100 identical black T-shirts, jeans, so on and so forth.
It was good for Eric Satie. It's good enough for me.
Yeah, well, it makes it easy, doesn't it? I mean, I always tell people, I've tried for the last 35 years. I walk into a clothes store and try and buy a colored shirt, and it's just not happening. You know, they're going to be black or white. That's it, or gray.
There's no point, and I think the amount of time that people waste in a lifetime trying to figure out what they're going to wear that day is time that could be better used elsewhere. So I just remove that from my daily routine.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
How do you think about food as well? I've got a reason for asking this question because there's somebody I know who does something similar.
This
to
is
you.
For the food, the food sanction, right? This is for the chefs that write it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I do appreciate food, but I would definitely label myself a meat and potatoes man.
Okay.
As long as it's tasty, I feel like I can eat the same thing almost daily.
Okay. So I had that conversation a million years ago with Phil Thornalley, who produced some of the Cure's records and played with us for a while. And he said to me one day that he viewed it purely as fuel. Food is just fuel, and that's it. The time spent eating it was time he could be doing, other creative things. You know?
Whereas for us, Lol, the fuel was like alcohol, wasn't it? There was very little time for eating.
Yeah, I lived on that.
My question in response to that is this gentleman on the thinner side, if he's not really enjoying his food and he's just eating for sustenance, is he very thin?
Yes, he is actually. I saw something. Somebody sent me a video a couple of days ago where he was extolling my drum playing on pornography, which makes me very happy that he said that. So, Phil, must be a couple of years younger than us. So he's like, you know, 60. And he still looks like wafer thin and very, very smart. And I'm not just saying that because he said nice things about me. I'm saying it because it's true.
Yeah, that's when we had a metabolism that worked.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I'm, you know, I keep making excuses for myself because, yes, I am getting a little older, you know, 34 now.
Oh, good Lord.
I was making the excuse of, you know, packing on some pandemic pounds, but I really got to get out there and run or do something, which I despise doing.
Oh.
You know, it's a real problem when I'm not touring.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I mean, even I, actually, my last gig was working with John Grant, his singer-songwriter. It wasn't the most demanding in the drum department. Mm-hmm. And the food was good and there was a lot of time. Yeah. And when you're not kind of running the show and you're just playing your gig, you know, I realized I used to burn a lot of pounds off just running around doing everything. You know, when we had like the Creatures, it was just two of us. And I was basically...
You did most of it, right?
Making sure all the band were okay. Yeah, I'd like sound check everything, you know?
Yeah, you know, especially with Nine Inch Nails or even with Angels and Airwaves, the stuff is energetic. A lot of it's up-tempo. With Nine Inch Nails, it's very aggressive a lot of the time. Right. So I'm up there doing...
Nine Inch Nails aggressive? What do you mean? You know? It's quite a laid-back band, really, aren't they?
But it's funny because... On stage, I'm out there giving it my all, and when I'm not on tour, I'm pretty much in this chair, not doing that, you know. And I'm one of those people who detests exercising for the sake of it.
Yeah,
you know, I enjoy playing tennis, but that's me tricking my body into enjoying physical exertion. But I commend the people who can just say, you know what, I'm going to go work out for an hour because I personally can't fucking stand it.
Well, there's two schools of thought there. When I was like your age, Glenn, I thought pretty much the same. I would think, if I do exercise, I get dumb. You know, it made me feel like I was getting dumber, right? So I didn't want to do it, right? But I would force myself to do it because, you know, I'm playing drums and stuff. And as I've got older, though, the thing I've realized is it actually improves my... cognitive abilities to do some of that, you know, and it makes me feel happier because as one loses one's testosterone, you can fall prey to depression, you know, and stuff like that. So I actually find it very, very good. Seeing as I don't do any other things anymore to, you know, alleviate my position, as it were, mentally. So I actually now I'm a fan of it. Now I will go 5 days a week to the gym. And I had to tell you something else.
Impressive.
Well, thank you. Yeah. The last tour I did with The Cure, there were only three people in the morning in the gym on that tour. One was myself. One was Jason Cooper, The Cure's drummer. And the other one was Simon Gallup. And I think that's no mystery to people that have followed The Cure that those three people, you know, myself included, would be at the gym.
So what you're telling me is that The Cure to depression is exercise, but it has to be done in the morning because that would be a problem too.
Well, when I say morning, I mean morning in the rock term of the word. I mean, you know, when you wake up from when you are on tour.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, see, lol, that's probably it. Probably Robert was probably in the gym all night. Right.
Yes.
Because he
Mr. Nocturnal, he's probably there all night. Wow. Well,
you know,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have been.
I know that's not true. Not that it wasn't all night, too. But I know Robert was not in the gym.
No, he was not. No. And, you know, I changed my lifestyle a lot about 30 years ago. And so, you know, and I've realized that I'm a person of extremes. I'm black or white. You know, I'm either going to do everything all one way or everything the other way. So now, you know, I'm non-drinking, non-drug-taking, non-smoking, vegan, you know. That's what I do. But back in the day, things were a little different. But, you know, it just depends how long you want to go before you get that message that, hey, This is not forever, and you could just check out.
Here's a question. Between giving up drugs, alcohol, or meat, which one was the most difficult?
Actually, giving up smoking was the most difficult. I'm gonna sidestep your question.
Yeah,
smoking.
No, that's interesting.
Yeah, I couldn't give up smoking until about 17 years ago, and it was like everything else I gave up 30 years ago. Smoking was, you know, just drive me mad to try and do that.
Do you know, I'm gonna be really honest. It's a good one because I thought alcohol was hard, but it wasn't. It was easy to stop. It wasn't so easy to stay stopped, and I tried a few times. Smoking, easy. Put them down. Like, they smell. They really, like, so I... And when I got into the studio, when I got my own computer and things like that for the first time, I realized that it was either smoking or, you know, doing the work, because it was a small studio room. And I also saw the inside of some machines in studios where smoking was, and they were full of gunk.
No.
And you only need to see that once. You don't have to open up a lung or anything. Well, there's the other thing. So smoking, drinking, drugs were like always recreational. You know, somebody else bought them, I might have indulged, but I never really.
Right.
I didn't send the taxi across London, you know, with a... Yeah, I might have done.
Yeah, that's what I... That's I raised an... arched an eyebrow there, dear listeners. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, we need a mix of that song. Can you get it now? It's like 3 a.m. Send a taxi. Yes. But the hardest thing was, I think it was meat, because I was not a big meat eater. It wasn't a big part of my diet, but I did like things I grew up with, like those little pork pies you got at parties. You know, there's like pastry, and especially if they were cold, it meant that the jelly had melted, and it was just, and God knows what was in them. So this is where I come to the big owner,
you know? Revelation.
So I've left France. I'm hovering around some, you know, car park near Tesco in Bedford somewhere, north of London, thinking, oh, I really like the sound of a pork pie, you know. So I go into the supermarket under the guise of buying things I do need, you know, maybe some juice, something healthy, and then I slip one of these pies in as well. And it's only little, so nobody's noticing, you know. And I go back to the car in the car park, and I say, and now we can do the... thing, whatever it is. And then I feel really guilty, and then I feel bad. So I'm getting over that now. I'm not killing myself too much.
I have to admit, I'm far too much of a carnivore to give it up. Now, I will say that since being married, my wife is a pescatarian. So
yes, so you're heading that way.
Yeah, we just naturally eat things or go to places that are conducive to both our diets. So I have had a sort of residual decline in my meat intake, but let's say she's out with friends, something in my body says eat a lot of meat while she's gone. Not that she minds, but it's just I need it. It's too good.
I think you have to listen to your body. Your body's telling you what you need a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Unless it's particularly really, really bad for you, then don't listen to your body then. Children, please don't listen to your body when it says eat that thing that you...
My body used to tell me a whole load of crap that I should eat and do and stuff, you know.
No, actually, this is what it wasn't. We were not really listening to our bodies. It was our twisted, addled brains that
that's
were
what it is, yeah.
To do all that bad stuff.
The one thing that I'm really surprised in there, you know, and I think that I know you fairly well, is about the smoking. So I don't think you were ever really a smoker then, because it's kind of hard, that one.
Me? I went from, you know, smoking the regular tip cigarettes to, you know, rolling my own cigarettes, which is kind of like more like kind of good if you're behind the kit. So you just like spit it out and it won't burn a hole in the carpet. It just goes out, you know.
Right.
And not that I ever did that, you know. You can't really drum with a cheroot hanging out your mouth, you know.
Not that Steve Jones ever stumped a cigarette out in the middle of a really expensive studio on the carpet while he was playing either.
Here's a question for you guys. Now, when you, the way you have your drums either sit up at home or whenever you play for pleasure, how do you like right. the sound of your drums? You like them nice and open? You like them dampened? What's your personal taste as players?
I have a very small bunker in Berlin, and it's a drum room.
I've heard of a bunker in Berlin before.
I know where it is. I couldn't get to use that particular one because they demolished it.
It's under a parking lot now, right?
It's under a building, under a building, under a building. The first street I landed in and got, found a place to rent and, it's about 10 years ago, but anyway, I still have my drums down there, but I was lucky because there's like an inner courtyard, these old warehouse buildings, and which are kind of residential, but they used to have factories in the back, or now they're full of art studios and design studios. And I've got a flamenco dance troupe above my particular thing, which is not good fun when you're trying to record something. So in the room, I share it with an orchestral percussionist. He has five full-size timpani. He has a marimba, tubular bells. We've got lots of percussion down there in a small space. So when I hit my bass drum, it goes through five timpanis.
Ah, so you get a nice ring, huh?
And there's two other kits down the other end of the room. And I love this. I love this sound. I still have the old Gretsch kit that I had, which is kind of oversized. And I rarely dampen it. I love hearing the note of the shell and the zing of the hoop. I play on the hoops, and to me I've done my hearing no good, especially in that small room. But it's the bane of every sound engineer's life. And we had this thing where I still do. If I get to a studio, I rip all the gaffer tape off. It doesn't matter how carefully somebody's put it on there. You know, you can tell that they put gaffer tape on a little, like, looks like a caterpillar's crawled across the head.
Yeah.
You know, and you go like, get rid of that, get rid of the sponge. And, you know, and then you're left with a really crap sounding drum. And then you got to work on it.
Yeah.
And I love that part of setup as well. I love some drums you just can't. You keep going and you go and you change the heads and you realize the drum's out of shape and the hoop doesn't fit.
It makes no bloody difference after a while. Yeah, I know.
But sometimes you hit a magic thing where the drum just goes, and it's live and it's live and it's like touching electricity almost, you know.
Well, I'm not an endorsee of this particular thing, but I found something the other day because a few years ago, somebody asked me, they wanted to make me a custom kit. And I said, okay. They said, well, what do you want it to be like? What do you want on it? I said, well, just basic, you know, Ringo four piece, you know, but I want it to sound like the album I did, this album Pornography. And I told them that's how I want it to sound, which it's going to be a bit difficult because that was all to do with, you know, mics and the room and stuff as well. But they made me something that was great. They've got the loudest frigging snare drum I've ever had, you know, and it's like a chamber snare. So it has like two shells inside one another. And,
oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it just amplifies it. So it's really loud. And I had a lot of problem like tuning it up, getting it so that it was a nice sound, a nice crack to it, but that it sounded, that it kept going, that it didn't have, it wasn't just sort of stopped in the middle of space somewhere, you know, like, and I tried little gels and stuff and none of that crap worked, you know. Somebody told me, oh, get this, which is like it's like a little rubber ring that fits around the top and it's also part of a drum head. And you just lay it on and you have all the middle part to do it. You don't even attach it in any way. And it just makes that beautiful thud with the real snare crack behind it, and it's instantaneous. So, you know,
that's nice.
Yeah, so I really like that. And to your question, well, you know, I have a little home, but just seen it. I have a little home studio in my garage.
That's where I'm going to live, right?
That's where you're going to live, yeah. Well, actually, I had the builder around today to tell him what you need. You know?
You can leave the drum kit, and then I'll be home from home.
I like to play very loud, you know, that's it. It's like, you know, as loud as possible, mainly because I've got hearing loss as well. So, you know, I want to hear that. But
there's no hope for us, really. We've both got tinnitus.
There's no hope, no. And do you find this as well? It's really, it was kind of upsetting to me. Pearl Thompson in The Cure, you know, is like one of the loudest guitarists you're ever going to hear. His big hero is Jimmy Page. You know?
Same.
Yeah, right. So he played with Jimmy Page, with Page and Plant a few years back, and Pearl told me, Paige would come up to him and go, "You are so frigging loud. You know, why?" And it's like, this comes from Jimmy Page, right? So,
yeah.
So we used to isolate Pearl on the side of the stage with like Perspex stuff and things, you know, because if you walked across the front of the stage with The Cure, you know, like you walk across the front of me, you'd hear a bit of me, a bit of Robert, some drums and stuff. Walk across Robert, you'd hear like, you know, Robert's voice and stuff and his guitar, all the stuff you'd expect. You walk in front of Pearl and all you hear is Pearl. How the hell he kept in time with everybody, because he couldn't hear anybody else at all, you know?
Yeah.
But he's got perfect hearing. He's got perfect hearing, you know, and we're all left with less of it. Well, I think it's because it's like drums are so explosive, you know, your hearing hasn't got time to adjust.
Like when we're on the kit and we hit the kit, it doesn't sound loud, but when somebody else gets on your kit and they hit, like they tap the snare drum, you go like, ah, that's so loud.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the only hearing loss that I'm aware of, because I had a test done a couple of years ago before I got some new molds, I have a notch in my hearing from the metronome, which is it's a bummer. But I don't even notice it because it's such a specific frequency. And
right.
As you can imagine, fear of losing the click during a Nine Inch Nails show is the worst. And I always have it far above everything else, but it's just such a persistent thing. It's such a volume that you just see it on the graph.
Wow.
But you have like, I mean, I certainly had to, with the advent of in-ears, then monitoring became a different ball game, you know, where I tried early headphones for the first time. The Banshees were using Track. And it was literally like DAT tapes, you know, running live.
Yeah.
But I remember the realization that if you lost the click, you know, I used to have...
Oh, it's terrifying.
I had the system with the Creatures where we were running sequence stuff, but we had no in-ears. So we had to have silence and had to have a way of following the click without it being heard.
Uh-huh.
Now, so Susie couldn't hear it. I had no headphones. What I had was a system that was devised for another band in Britain, and I got their drummer and I said, what's LEDs, one green, one red.
Yeah.
And they were down funnels so that they wouldn't be affected by stage lighting.
Oh, wow.
And it was red, green, 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 red, green, green. So I could watch. Yeah. And after a few shows, it's in muscle memory anyway. So once you've got the BPM set and you know the song. But it was just that little security of seeing it.
Yeah. Actually, that sounds like a really good idea. I mean, it's funny because this weekend, some friends of mine asked me to play on a track, and they said, you know, and they're like, you know, of this generation. Sorry.
I hate this generation. It's fine.
It's first thing on their mind. So they're like, well, where do you want the click? And I said, you know what? I would prefer just to play, like, turn the bass up. Because the bass is sequenced, you know. Mm. Turn the bass up, and I'd prefer to play against the bass, you know, and the voice.
Yeah.
And the voice, because that's what I always did with the Cure. I'm playing against the bass and the voice. I'm not playing against, you know, something ticking away in my head, because I'm always thinking, oh, shit, am I behind? I'm in front, I'm behind, you know. Hate it. I'd rather play with the musicality of even if it is something that's generated.
So when you've got something that's... The music of Nine Inch Nails, the type of accuracy required in a way. You've not got a lot of milliseconds to play with.
No, and it's not just a matter of being in time with the click. I mean, obviously, we're talking about sequences, and we're talking about stuff that if it's just not tight, it sounds sloppy. And I was just thinking right now about losing a click. The one time it ever happened to me, which was not... a mix issue. I am fairly energetic when I play, and I did something, and I pulled my in-ears clean out of my head.
Uh-huh.
And this was at the farewell show 14 years ago. So I'm up on stage singing. This might be the last one. This is the first song of the set, which is a 9/8, you know, not one that you play to too often. And fortunately, there are counts in certain parts of the songs just to make sure that everything kind of locks back in. And as I pull this, you know, this pair of in-ears out of my head, my face goes white and I'm just like freaking out. I see people starting to turn around to look at me, wondering why I'm drifting. And thank God there's a break in the song towards the bridge where I was able to get them back on. The count comes in and then we all lock back in. But that was just a moment I never wish to experience again. And there have been moments where I'm sure you guys have experienced this sometime, either the mixing desk goes out or something due to a power failure.
Yeah.
And everything cuts out and you're wondering, is it just me or is everyone not hearing this either? Yeah. And it's terrifying. It's awful.
Well, my worst moment recently was on the Reflections tour, you know, which was a few years back. And Robert said, okay, well, you know, we'll do the first three albums. We'll do all the B-sides, everything that we put out. And some of those songs we never played live ever. You know, we just sort of did them in the studio. And so we had to figure out how to play them. And there was this one song, I forget which one it was now, but there's the point of one song where it's like, well, we're probably just going to let it go for a few more bars. And when it comes to the time, you know, that this section comes back in, I'll just raise the guitar up a little bit like this, and you'll know that's a signal that it's four bars into the next, you know, next section. And I'm going like, okay, great. Come the night of the show at the Sydney Opera House, and the Cure have had the same lighting designer for years. He favours lots of smoke and dry ice and anything like that when he can get hold of it. So halfway through this song that we've never played live before, the dry ice comes and it starts to rise higher, and then the smoke comes and I can't see, you know, it's at the Opera House, so I'm fair way across the stage. I can't see Robert's head, let alone the guitar. I can't see anything, you know. Mm-hmm. And we keep playing away and I'm thinking, oh, shit, when's it going to end? When are we going to end? And suddenly I just see this guitar fly out of the top of the smoke. He's put it above his head like this, you know, just to sort of wave it up like a flag.
That is funny. And any sort of difficulties due to smoke, I feel everyone's pain.
Yeah.
I couldn't find my drum set on stage. Yeah. This is for the first song.
Yeah.
You know, you hear the intro going, and I'm like, okay, time to go. Where are the drums? And I actually ended up, Alessandro, who's the sort of the setup next to me with his keyboards and whatever, I'm like, wrong instrument. I must be over there. That's terrifying. But
I used to do that, but it was usually due to a few large shots of something beforehand. Which way is the stage?
I've only had that feeling once where I go, I really, really can't. I couldn't hit that bass drum tonight. If I hit that bass drum, I'm going to do it wrong.
Yeah.
When the kit is just looking and the whole gig is going like, you're going to fuck up. You're really going to mess up tonight. Yeah. You know? Do we all have those moments?
Mm. Yeah. You reminded me of one of the worst ones for me. With like, you know, I was playing keyboards and I'm stuck on this riser up in the middle of things and all the smoke's going. And then the strobes start going. Yeah. And the strobes, like, I was like, I better hold on to the side of the keyboard, otherwise I'm going to fall over because this is just setting my equilibrium, you know, sideways, and I can't see anybody or anything, and I'm just like, oh, when's it going to stop?
You know, I wouldn't call it PTSD, but when I hear mention of smoke and strobes, I'm immediately transported to another place in my mind. I'm like, yeah.
It's not a nice place, is it? Not a good place.
Oh, goodness.
I noticed something doing a bit of due diligence, Elon, is that I had a look at your website and I saw that lovely video you have of a song with you playing all the instruments. And I noticed, and maybe this is just because it's for video, but I noticed that you seem to play every other instrument right-handed, but drums, you play like the left and the right hands are doing opposite things than I would do. What is that?
Yes, that is. It's very, very good observation, I should say.
It's a drummer's observation.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what. I would consider myself right-handed, generally speaking. The only two things I do left-handed are hit the hi-hat and right.
Right.
I don't know how that came to be, but as a kid, learning to play drums, my dad once taught me something and said, all right, I'm going to go into the house and come back and get me when you've figured it out. And he left me there and I was practicing it. And I just had a very naive thought as a 7.5, 8-year-old. I'm like, why am I hitting this if this is closer?
Yeah.
And that was it. It wasn't any sort of knowledge of thinking, well, I write with my left hand, I must be left-handed, therefore I'll play drums that way. Because it's really not a left-handed approach per se, because, you know, I'm still hitting the bass drum with the right. Like Dom Howard from Muse, who's a good friend, is the only proper left-hander who I know, and one of the only proper left-handers I can think of.
Yeah.
But it is funny when people realize that I play open-handed, like, oh, there's another one of us out there. But I remember calling my dad and saying, okay, I got it, I figured it out, and I started playing, and he was very perplexed because he was like, well, it sounds right, but it does not look right. And he let me proceed that way, but he took me to a drum clinic. It was a Dave Weckl drum clinic.
Okay.
And come the Q&A portion of the clinic, my dad asked what do I do? And he said, let him do whatever comes naturally. Now,
that's good.
As an adult, the only thing I can make sense of is I sort of see the left and right sides of my body split between power and finesse. And when I say power, I mean I throw, I swing a racket, I kick, everything right-handed. But when it comes to the left hand, you know, you're writing, you're on the fretboard, you're hitting the hi-hat, it's all a bit more delicate. And that's the only thing I can think of is something that makes sense to me as to why the things I do left-handed.
It wasn't Ringo. Ringo was left-handed but played a right-handed kit.
Yes, which is why his signature way of phrasing fills is the way it is, because he'd stop playing to lead with his left, which I think is an amazing way of coming up with that.
That's a thing that's revealed itself to me over time, and the advent of some analytical stuff as well, which never was available. But I think it's the relaxation, maybe in introducing a click as well. But I used to always have to keep at least eights going, you know, somewhere on my kit. And I started to do it with my left foot, which kind of...
Yes.
It was just that. And I thought, hang on, I could put a tambourine on there. And that saw Bonham with his tambourine as well.
I think an element of the Led Zeppelin rhythm section that maybe a lot of people wouldn't go to, because, you know, riffs and heaviness and whatever sort of stereotypes are attached to Led Zeppelin. The Motown swing is a colossal element of why those things felt as good as they did. Yeah. So there's that it's almost like a groove based swing as opposed to a swing.
John Paul. There you go. Yes.
Oh, it's absolute gold. But yeah, that sort of, you listen to great Motown tracks and rhythm sections, even though they may be straightforward backing a pop song, so to speak, they just they have a groove in them, and that directly, in my estimation, led to why those riffs just were as satisfying as they were.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, as human beings, that's what we look for. We look for things that are satisfying. Yeah,
I thought it was interesting the introduction of Motown into this discussion, because it was so much a part of in Northwest Britain at that time, Motown and soul, Northern soul,
right,
and the all night parties. It's all about dance,
yeah.
But there was the swing elements, and these things kind of come in, but only introduce themselves maybe in your playing as you get a little older, and you don't really know where it came from, because reggae came into Britain as well with the generation of migrant workers that came over from Jamaica, and the music followed them. And then, and being around Liverpool and I'm sure London, but as a port, Liverpool was a key place where we had a lot of migrant workers, and as long with the Irish, we had a lot of Jamaican families, and the music followed, and reggae became a part of that, our growing up culture. And it was so alien.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I always wondered, where did I get this kind of African feel from, you know, that this love of that love of the sound of bigger and fatter and rounder and not quite together sort of drumming.
I know this is probably going to cause an eye roll in which I'm apologizing in advance. In terms of... no, in terms of reggae, I'm not very knowledgeable. And I love... Now, here's where the eye roll is going to come in. Mm. I absolutely love the Police. And I know that Sir Copeland, Sting, I know they picked up what they incorporated. There we go. You know, in terms of the inversion of where the backbeat is and that kind of stuff, I find it very interesting. But whereas the Police kind of get this white reggae thing, for lack of a better term, what I found interesting is that Stuart Copeland actually grew up in the Middle East. And I heard him say somewhere that the reggae rhythm to him made sense because of a Lebanese rhythm that he grew up listening to that had the same inversion of the backbeats. And I don't know if you call it balladi or something like that, but having grown up listening to that, when reggae and punk and all these things were fusing in the UK, he apparently thought, well, I can do that. I know how that rhythm works. And I just thought that was really fascinating and interesting, because there's so many places where rhythms become unique and they invert in their own ways, and then everything kind of cross-pollinates. And it's funny that the Police, to some, being a sort of gateway into that style of playing, it didn't actually originate from there, which is, I just think, is interesting.
I think they got away with it. I think Stuart Copeland got away with a kind of hybrid, because there was enough like English rock going on, and there was enough space guitar coming in from Andy. I call him Andy. Mm. I don't know him, but we all know the Police, right?
Yeah.
Stuart Copeland, yeah, because if you were like, became like UB40 from Birmingham, surrounded by musicians they came from their roots. It's sort of, you know, as much as I, you know, nice guys, but it sounded sort of a pastiche in a way, because I don't think reggae in Jamaica really stood still. It always seemed to be adopting beats from pop music from other parts of the world. And I'm just making, first of all, just the sound of the drums different. It wasn't necessarily always putting the snare drum where you know, dropping the one, wherever it might be. So Stuart, in a way, was kind of doing the same game, like putting in Jamaican or a rhythm that sounded like reggae, but then going into like hard rock as well. So the mix was seamless, as much as I hate to say it.
Also, the aesthetic of the traditional grip, I think, just makes him a very unique player. Now, I was actually going to mention, we were talking about playing to clicks, or you're saying playing to the bass track or whatever. As opposed to playing to a metronome, Stuart Copeland liked to play to echoes as a method of staying in time without playing to a click, which I think is unique.
Oh, no, he's just being weird. That's what he is.
Yeah.
I love the idea of playing to that kind of thing. We tried different things in the studio so we didn't have to rely on a click. And
I used to play to the voices in my head. No, they were quite good.
I still do, lol. Still do. Yes,
I harmonize with the voices in my head.
I used to harmonize with the expeller in the toilet of the Liverpool Philharmonic pub. I used to go around the pubs, and depending on the time of day and the time of evening and my state of inebriation, I'd have to find the pitch of the and then harmonize with it, and I'd be standing there pretending. And say, you've been gone ages. Says, yeah, it's a particularly good expeller and ye old crack.
It probably drives my wife nuts, but when I have a electronic toothbrush, and that always goes to the same pitch. And as a habit, I just go, I go to major and then minor. Yeah, it's like, it's just satisfying.
Yes, I'm teaching my children the same trick at the moment.
That's good.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.